from Capital Public Radio, I'm Douglas Everett, filling in for host Jeffrey Callison. Human trafficking will be addressed in a congressional forum tomorrow in Rancho Cordova. Representative Dan Lundgren will host, and we'll talk to him about their aims later in the program. If you've ever contemplated adventure travel on a bicycle, or haven't, Sacramento native Willie Weir has some things he'd like to tell you. And the Jay versus Conan late-night TV squabble is something that local radio host Phil Cowan has more than a few insights on. He'll share what he experienced later on the show. But first, the name Margot Adler will no doubt ring a bell to NPR listeners. Her reports have been part of Morning Edition and All Things Considered for years. You know her as a radio correspondent, but Margot Adler has also been a best-selling author on the subject of paganism. In fact, she's giving a talk in Stockton this evening at the University of the Pacific as part of the Colliver Lecture Series, which explores religion in modern society. The talk is titled Paganism, Religion, Not Superstition. Margot Adler, welcome to Insight.
Glad to be here.
You wrote a book, Drawing Down the Moon, Witches, Druids, Goddess Worshippers, and Other Pagans in America Today, considered by some to be the authoritative guide to pagans in the U.S. Can we start with kind of a thumbnail sketch of what American paganism encompasses?
Well, I think the best way to think about it, because there's so many stereotypes about pagans. You know, pagans are seen as atheists, hedonists, Satanists, you know, what else, you know. But really, if you think about it, what we're really talking about is earth-based traditions, sort of like tribal traditions, sort of like indigenous traditions like Native American and so forth, but a contemporary form of that. And what they basically are religions that sort of look to the ancient ways of thinking about religion before there were scriptures. So how do we make the crops grow? Looking at the moon, the seasons, all those kinds of things, seasonal celebrations, coming of age celebrations, all those kinds of things. So pagan groups in the United States, and there are thousands of them with lots of different traditions, revivals of Norse and Greco-Roman, Wiccans, and all kinds of people, and people who just look at sort of are looking for a kind of ecological, nature-based religion. And that's what we're really talking about. And at this point, the reason that it's really interesting to look at these groups is that they are huge in the sense that there are now probably something between 500,000 to 750,000 contemporary pagans in the U.S. In fact, if you go to a website called adherence.com, which tracks, you know, how many Lutherans are there in Idaho and so forth, there are about 1 million pagans in worldwide. It's considered the 19th most popular religion.
Wow.
Who would have known, right?
I'm very surprised. Do you think a lot of listeners may be what you describe as pagans, just maybe not think of themselves using that term?
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, I got involved because I was reading the nature writers. I was reading Thoreau and Lauren Isley and René Dubos, and I was looking for, and there was clearly a spiritual dimension to that writing. And I was kind of looking for a religion that would be, or a spiritual view that would be in keeping with the modern world. In other words, I could get up in the morning and be a doctor, a lawyer, a computer programmer. I didn't have to give up my intellectual integrity. There wasn't a lot of dogma, but that had a sense of connection with the planet, with something more than what we were seeing, and that wasn't the kind of white bread religion that I was experiencing in my sort of local church or synagogue where you just come in and you sit in the pews and people read you something and you sing a bunch of hymns. You know, I wanted something a little more ecstatic. And I think that's why I got involved, certainly.
Well, you describe it, paganism, as kind of an ecological religion for you, and I guess you're interested in some of these magic or occult aspects to it. But how do those elements combine?
Well, I am not particularly interested in the occult and magical aspects, although a lot of other people are. I am more interested, for example, in the feminist aspects of this religion. A lot of women got involved in these religions because there was no place, now there's more, but there was no place in the 60s, certainly in the 70s, when these religions began in the United States, for them to achieve ministry. They couldn't become priests. They couldn't become rabbis in the Orthodox Jewish tradition. They still can't. They now can in conservative Judaism. It was even hard in Episcopal organizations. And so many of them were desperate for a sense of ministry, and they, to some extent, looked at the ancient goddesses and this whole idea of, well, was there a religion that they could create where they could have this sense of ministry? So for me, I think beauty, imagination, feminism, ecology were the things that I think are most important. But yeah, sure, there are people who think of themselves are interested in magic and occult, just not me.
Well, in this broader field of paganism, where does the Wiccan religion fit in?
Wicca is really the paganism of the European West. In other words, it is the revival of sort of ancient traditions in modern form that were pre-Christian, and a lot of this pagan revival is what you might say is pre-Christian. As a matter of fact, let me put it this way. If you go back, all of our ancestors were probably pagans. Depends how far you go back. I mean, right? If you go back to Ireland, probably you only have to go back to like the 13th century, 12th century, whatever. If you have to go back to people who are Jews, you have to go like 6,000, 7,000, whatever years. But all of our ancestors, and if you think about the United States of America, when you think about that, everybody who came here in some way because their traditions were destroyed. If they're black, they were destroyed by slavery. They had African traditions, pagan traditions, they were destroyed. If they're Native American, destroyed through colonialism, and a lot of those traditions are mostly destroyed. And if they are white, you know, Caucasian Americans, they came to this country, assimilated as fast as possible throughout all those traditions, throughout the dances, the coming of age ceremonies, the chants, the lullabies, all of that stuff. And so what I think we're seeing, and then I'll get back to Wicca in a second, is I think the reason that this has become so popular is people are desperate to revive that, the positive aspects of those kinds of traditions without the authoritarianism, without all the other kind of negativity that some of those traditions had.
Well, speaking of authoritarianism, I want to ask, do you meet any resistance in public talks? I think of that biblical verse, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And of course, people are familiar with what happened in Salem, Massachusetts and things.
Sure. I mean, you get people who have a literal reading of scripture from a Christian point of view. And I say, you know, look, we're not, or who say that, let's say, witches are Satanists. And then what you say to them is, Satanism is a Christian reversal. If you turn a cross upside down, you're still thinking about a cross. If you're thinking, if you say the Lord's Prayer backwards, you're thinking about the Lord's Prayer. What paganism is all those beliefs that were previous to Christianity. They were prior. They're not anti-Christian. They're prior to Christian. So you wanted to know about Wicca, right?
Well, I mean, you're practicing Wiccan. Is that the same thing as saying that you're a witch?
Well, it's a religious term and not a magical term. I'm not a particularly I don't have any more occult abilities than you do, probably. You know, I'm sort of a more agnostic pagan, and I ended up in Wicca because that was the group in the neighborhood, and I spent a lot of time in Wicca. But I'm actually more interested in the generic ecological, environmental paganism. And I was just telling you before we went on the air that if people go to Avatar and see what that connection is and what you feel when you're in that forest as those people, you will have a really good sense of what contemporary paganism is trying to be.
Well, now I'm going to have to go see it. We've been speaking with NPR's Margot Adler about the subject of paganism, a matter she will cover at greater length tonight at the University of the Pacific. We'll have more information on our website, capradio.org/insight. Margot Adler, thank you for speaking with us, and good luck tonight.
It was a pleasure.
If you ever thought about packing up and touring a place like Laos or Guatemala on a bike, you'll want to hear from our next guest. And if you haven't ever even considered doing such a thing, I think you'll still want to hear from our next guest. So stay tuned. You're listening to Insight. I'm Douglas Everett. Sacramento native Willie Weir likes nothing better than to take the road less traveled, especially if the road is in a place like Bosnia or India, and his means of travel is his bicycle. He embarks upon grand bike adventures, then reports them for Adventure Cyclist magazine and public radio station KUOW in Seattle. His new book is the aptly titled Travels with Willie, Adventure Cyclist. For the next 3 nights, he'll be speaking at RAI in Sacramento to benefit 3 local nonprofits. Willie Weir, welcome to Insight.
My pleasure.
Willie, you tell again and again about how the bicycle gets people to open up to you when you're traveling, and you actually call it your passport. Mm-hmm. How does that work?
Well, the bicycle, at least in my opinion, is the last innocent form of transportation. There's something about it, and part of it is that when you're on a bicycle, you yourself are vulnerable. And because you are, people are willing to be vulnerable with you, and whether that be in South Africa and India and Bosnia. And because I traveled in South Africa the year Nelson Mandela had been elected president there, in areas that I probably, well, many people told me I shouldn't. And I met a white farmer who said, you know, the area you just came through, I wouldn't drive during the day. And the longest time we chatted, and we finally figured out that the reason was that he always traveled with a 9mm on his front. That's just the way you travel.
Right.
And as a cyclist, you're out there, you're open, and so people will approach you. You're not a threat.
Well, you tell again and again about going to places where you were sure you were going to come to grief, and you sort of have a policy that if the person hasn't been there themselves, then you don't tend to rely on that secondhand information.
Right. I always tell people, if you're going to travel somewhere, make sure, because you'll say, oh, I'm going to Colombia, or I'm going to Laos, I'm going to, and they'll say, oh, you know, I've heard that. And I always say, use the question, have you been there? And if they say no, say, you know, I'd rather not hear your opinion, because you will, you know, hear that their brother's hairdresser's friend's neighbor, you know, was mugged in Guatemala or
right.
whatever.
But you do take pains to point out that you do need to prepare a bit for an adventure travel.
Oh, definitely. And I think people who are adventure travelers are actually very safe in a lot of ways. You have to keep your ears open all the time, but you get your information on a day-to-day basis rather than waiting to, or looking at the State Department's website before you go to travel. I mean, that'll keep you away from everywhere on the planet pretty much.
Well, I like the fact you travel with a tent, mm-hmm. which saves a lot of money, but you note that you go out of your way to, quote, initiate kindness, mm-hmm. unquote. And how do you do that?
Well, part of finding a place to stay is usually asking people whether you can pitch your tent and whatnot. And there's something, again, about the bicycle. It would be hard doing this with a motorhome or traveling in another version. But on a bicycle with a tent, you're just looking for a flat place to stay. And people love to vicariously be involved in an adventure. And so in asking for a place to set up a tent, whatever, you allow people to be kind to you. And people don't get to do that very often in our society today. You know, we're told to, you know, if you see somebody's having a problem on the side of the road, call 911. Don't answer your door if you don't know the person. Enter the touring cyclist who really doesn't have anything that they're hiding. And it does allow people that opportunity to be kind. And so they're really, and on the other hand, on the other side, a lot of people around the world will never have the chance to travel in other places in the planet. So as the traveler, that exchange is you giving them vicariously the experience of being a traveler.
And I have to ask, too, you've got a degree in theater mm-hmm. right here at CSUS, and you go to a lot of places interacting with all the locals. Mm-hmm. Does the body language thing, being sort of a universal language, does that really help you out with acting ability?
I can't tell you how much. Well, acting, I think, you know, I can't tell you how much juggling has helped out, you know, in places where you don't speak the language. I mean, because, you know, little kids, 2-3 years old, just don't understand that you don't speak their language. And it's amazing how, and it's an icebreaker. It's a way to get people to smile. And I always tell people when you're traveling, and whether it be a bicycle or other way, it's always best to think about giving before you take. And that includes a photograph. And it can be as simple as taking the time to talk to somebody about their children, about their cropland, about the weather that day. I'm surprised how often people who jump off a tour bus and just start rattling away with their digital camera, now the video cams, and why they're surprised, why people are so angry. Well, I think most people would. It's an invasion. But in spending time with people, it's amazing how often you'll take the camera out and they're delighted to have you take their photograph. But you've given first. And I think that's really important.
Well, no doubt a lot of listeners are thinking that, boy, they'd like to travel, but they really should learn the local language before they do that. And, of course, knowing the language is a great idea, but you got out of your way to note that it's not necessarily all that critical.
I'm the poster child. I'm the poster boy for that because I failed miserably in Spanish in high school. I just don't have an affinity for languages. And to be honest with you, I was planning a trip across the southern United States and realized that my trips that I was planning mentally were in New Zealand and Australia and in England and Scotland. And I finally had to be honest with myself and realize that I was horrified to travel in a country where I didn't speak the language. And so instead of leaving from San Diego and going across the country, the nice thing about traveling alone is you can change your mind, I went south and I crossed the border into Mexico. And within 2 days, every single fear that had been involved with language was had just disappeared. And all of those locals, when I even tried my C-minus to D Spanish on them, were delighted. And the entire rest of the world opened up. And I talk about the language barrier. You have to get over it. And once you do, you realize that you can always communicate. And then sometimes knowing a little bit of a language can be a disadvantage because you spend what I call having the hour, 5-minute conversation. You know, you want to, well, what do you do for a living? Where if you don't know any language at all, you end up communicating in emotions and needs and whatnot. So that can often be a more enriching experience. Now, if I had the option to be multilingual, I would grab it. I mean, a friend of mine, you know, speaks 6 languages, and oh, I wish I could have her experience on the road. But maybe that's in my next time around on this planet. I'll be a linguist.
All right. The world is changing for travelers. I enjoyed your chapter you had on the internet in the book, and it sort of struck me what a mixed blessing it's now become to say go to a small town in Nicaragua, and yet you go to a internet cafe, and then you're chatting with your friends, and even though you're supposed to be, you know, away, you're still with, you're still hooked up to people.
Yeah, the internet, as I call it, the world's longest umbilical cord. And the fact that you can always be connected, and that's a lovely thing, but I think as a traveler, it can be a horrible thing as well. And part of that is that we can be 2 places at once, mentally. And what I've always loved about a bicycle adventure is being out there, you're in the elements, you truly are connected to a space, a culture, a people, like you can't be any other way. But if the moment you stop, you run into a cyber cafe and check your email, mentally, you are back at home and you're with bills and whatever, and it literally it's like listening to a symphony that gets interrupted like every minute with a commercial or maybe a radio station with commercials. It's a big difference not having them. And so yes, the internet's great, and part of it is like a tool. You have to learn how to use it, and it's so easy to abuse, and partially because it's free.
Well, you put so many plugs in the book for how if you take the small little road that goes in the middle of nowhere, you wind up interacting with the natives out of necessity, which is part of the whole goal. You have so many stories in there about great moments off the beaten track. Can you give us one?
Just, you know, off the beaten path. I mean, Kat and I did a trip. I mean, Kat's my wife. We did a trip in the deep south, and we were traveling, you know, the semi back roads, but we ended up, and there was a man had broken down in his truck. We could tell, and we couldn't figure out where we were going. And I was pointing at my map, and that guy said, "Oh, that is the damn wiggliest road I ever saw." And we ended up following that road, and we ended up actually spending the night in a single wide trailer with a man named Billy. And Billy, you know, he had kind of the mannerisms of like a 7-year-old, but this guy had to be 65. He worked on trucks. He's a diesel mechanic, but he had a gun right above the single wide, you know, trailer. And we ended up, you know, staying with him. And what's hysterical, dealing with stereotypes, is that man made us promise one thing before we left, and that was to send him Dahlia tubers. You know, and you think, but, you know, there's been so many opportunities I just think about my time right now, especially in South Africa, because now with the movie coming out with, you know, Clint Eastwood directed Invictus about that the rugby match that happened during Nelson Mandela. Well, I wish I'd say that I had planned to be there at that time, but I just happened to travel in South Africa in 1995 during that entire time when South Africa was going through the World Rugby Cup, and to actually be in that country and watch it transform in little town after little town as this country was watching what was an all-white sport, and to have Nelson Mandela walk in with that Springbok cap on his head, it was better than the movie. And it to watch how that great man could take a symbol of what was, apartheid and make it a symbol of peace. And to be able to bicycle through that experience was something I'll never, ever forget.
Well, you closed your book talking about how a person just tallying up what it's going to cost to go somewhere, they might be $15,000 down before they've bought a ticket or even purchased anything simply because of the obligations you have at home. That does stop some people. What do you say to those people?
Well, I say that if you're in high school or college, I say travel now. It will never, ever be easier. And I really, you know, and I was a professional actor working up in Seattle. And at that time, it was so easy for me to travel because I live in a dumpy apartment that I couldn't wait to get out of. You could see your breath in March in my apartment, you know. And so leaving was like a hummingbird just sailing off of a little twig. And now my wife and I taking off, it's like watching the space shuttle lift off. You know, there's just all this energy because we do. I mean, it's possessions. And part of it, I do. I love the place where I live. I love how I'm interacted in my community in Seattle. But the older you get, the harder it is, as I call, to escape the gravity of home that very often pulls you in. And the younger you are, the easier. And I was one of those people that said, well, it's not going to happen to me. You know, but it just naturally does. And in this culture, the hardest thing for us to have is time. And the most valuable decision, that a travel decision I ever made, that we ever made, was buying half the house our bank said we could, rather than 1.5 times. That one decision. I wish I'd had teachers that told me those things in high school, whatever, because that one decision in writing a mortgage or a car payment, whatever, can decide on not only your occupation, but whether you are going to travel and where and how often and whatever. Those little decisions, which we don't think about as travel decisions, are huge.
Well, we're just about out of time, Willie, but just before we go, can you give us a few favorite places to travel and which one might be good for a beginner to start with?
Oh, a beginner. Well, I mean, New Zealand is an outdoor Disneyland to go to. I would say, gosh, depends on what you don't go to India as a beginner, but you have to. But you have to go to India.
I'll second that.
Yes, you have to go as a traveler. Right now, what is very, very safe in the mountain regions, Colombia is an amazing place to travel, and I would definitely suggest that. So,
a provocative answer. I'm surprised by that, mm-hmm. but.
Yeah, you know, surprising, but I felt very safe in the coffee growing regions of Colombia and travel. It's a magical place. It really is.
Willie Weir will be speaking at REI tonight through Thursday about travel in general and adventure cycling in particular. It's a benefit for 3 nonprofit groups. We'll have information about the talks on our website, capradio.org/insight. Willie Weir, thanks for speaking with us.
We have one more show Saturday night at the Bicycle Kitchen. It's an added frugal cyclist show because it looks like tonight's show is sold out. So
all right,
7 p.m. there.
I'm sure we'll get that on the site as
okay.
well.
Thank you.
The Tonight Show battle between Jay and Conan's been in the news lately, but late night TV has often been a bit of a war zone. We'll talk with someone who took part in one of the battles after a short break. You're listening to Insight. I'm Douglas Everett. For 4 decades, The Tonight Show has battled competitors and won in the end. But the late-night slot has been a battleground strewn with bodies. Witness the recent dust-up with Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien. In the 80s, Fox tried to knock off Johnny Carson, first with Joan Rivers' The Late Show, which failed. They tried again with a variety of hosts without success, and in 1987 enlisted Sacramento's Paul Robbins and Phil Cowan as hosts to go head-to-head with Carson. Here to tell us a remarkable story of late-night TV is a man well-known to Sacramento radio listeners, Phil Cowan. Phil, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Douglas. Nice to be here. Boy, that was kind of a short break. Don't you guys have some commercials to play or something like that?
Not here.
Oh, come on. it was in 1987. And in fact, you know, interestingly enough, the president and general manager of Capital Public Radio, one Rick Etchison, and he and Rick and I are still friends, was our boss at that time. He had hired us to do mornings over at KAER, which later became Y-82 KGBY. And we had been there for just a couple of months when we got this call from a friend of ours. Paul and I had moved back here from Dallas in our morning radio travels, and we're working at Channel 3. The show that Jack Gallagher originally moved to Sacramento to do was called TV Light, and Paul and I were reporters on that show, and I anchored the news segment that was on at the beginning of the program. And when that got canceled, because John Kelly, I don't think he ever knew quite what to make of the show, he got rid of that, and Julie Engelman, the woman who produced it, called Paul and I one day and said, hey, you got to call these people at Fox. And we said, what for? And she said, because they were looking at my tape, I was down here looking for a job, and they're doing this new late night show, and they want 2 people to host it. And we said, yeah, right, okay. And so
to go against Johnny Carson.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we called them and wound up going down for a couple of screen tests and, you know, the long and short of it is we wound up getting this job. And I still remember when we got the call that we were going to be the guys, and I had to call Etch and say, hey, we need to talk to you about something. And it's like 7:30, 8 o'clock in the evening. Yeah, what about? I said, well, I want to tell you in person. Can we get to go get a drink or something? Okay, fine. And I want to say we met in the bar in, oh, what the hell is that hotel down at the end of Fulton Avenue and Auburn? Anyway, we're in there. And he said, so what's going on? And I said, well, you know, I explained what had happened. And he said, wow, man. That's kind of a relief. I thought you were going to tell me you were leaving to take a radio job somewhere. And I said, Rick, I don't think we'd leave for a radio job, but this is a pretty hot opportunity. He goes, oh, come on, you got to go.
Yeah.
So we went down and we did this show called the Wilton North Report, and God, was it awful.
Well, I have to ask, but first of all, it was called Late Night. Everyone sort of got the idea Late Night. Joan Rivers was called Late Night.
Right.
And they called it that with some other hosts. And then when you guys came along, they got the bright idea, let's imitate the McNeil-Lehrer Report and call it the Wilton North Report.
Exactly. Well, and it was an entirely new product for late night television. It was not going to be the traditional late night format. They wanted it to be more of a, I think if today Barry Sand, the guy that produced this show, if he saw the Daily Show with Jon Stewart or Colbert, he'd go, that's what I had in mind. But he could never somehow distill that and make it happen on screen.
Sounds like you had trouble meshing things, because I know reading the story, and there's a lot of this on the web, some of the inside reporting by Paul Krasner, interesting article in Spy Magazine, et cetera, that they had the writers all set up and assured these guys this is going to be a writer's show, boys, and then they brought you guys on last.
Yes, we were the last people they hired on the show, and the writing staff included some very talented people. I don't necessarily include Krasner among them. but Krasner was there, Paul Slansky, who I think spent some time writing for Salon, probably still does, and is a frequent contributor to the Huffington Post. I don't know if that's anything I'd want on my resume, but Conan O'Brien was on that staff.
One of your writers.
Yes. As was Greg Daniels, who was, I believe, the executive producer at one time of King of the Hill, the animated series, and developed The Office for American television. A very, very bright bunch of kids working. And Barry Sand was a guy who had been the network producer. He was the NBC guy on Late Night with David Letterman early on. And I think always felt ostracized by the writing staff there. Barry always considered himself a writer, and he always felt like the guy on the outside.
Well, I have to ask you about that. What I read said that at Letterman, they excluded him specifically from the writers' meetings.
Yeah, they did. And I think he was always very bitter about that. And he had, the first thing he did was hire the writing staff that he wanted and assured the writers, this is going to be a smart writer's show. This is your show. Well, then they hired a couple of guys, and, you know, obviously we wanted to go out and do stuff that we thought was of a certain quality. And mostly, that was funny. We wanted to make people laugh. It was a late night show.
I also want to interject. Before you got on the radio, you guys were comics.
Yeah, I mean, that was what we did. And we never really intended on being in radio. We just wanted to somehow make a living making people laugh. So we go down there, and a lot of this stuff, I mean, you know, I walk into Paul Slansky's office one day, and he has, in his feet are up on his desk and in his lap propped open, he's looking at the Mikado. I said, Paul, what are you doing? I'm trying to work up a bit oh, that's going to be rich. Oh, that'll have him on the floor. Yes, but that's kind of what we fought.
Satire and Pilgrim's Progress.
Yeah. So we had this writing staff that thought it was their show, and, you know, they bring in these two, what they considered to be bumpkins, really, from Sacramento, and it just never happened. It was not a marriage made in heaven.
I got to tell you, I was reading up on this, reading about what this was like for you, ineffectual boss, contentious writers, concepts not worked out. I got up at 2:30 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. It gave me nightmares. I can't imagine what this was like for you. I literally could not sleep thinking about what this must have been like.
I didn't lose much sleep over it. It was very disappointing because when we went down there, I mean, it was a lark. We just thought, oh, come on, really? And we wound up getting the job, and we thought, oh, this is going to be so much fun. And the sad truth of it was that it wasn't fun at all. It was a real grind, and the contentious atmosphere down there did not make for a happy workplace.
And I noticed you had Jack LaLanne as a fitness consultant. How
did we
he did. Fit
Jack,
in?
Jack was a contributor, and, you know, and in fact, I think Conan was kind of the guy who managed Jack. He wrote the Jack LaLanne bits, and they were very funny. And I have to defend Conan here because Barry Sand was always going, oh, come on, you're making Jack LaLanne look silly. And he did, because that's what Conan does. I mean, Conan, he's at his best when he's ridiculous. And he would do silly things with Jack LaLanne. I have to tell you, Jack LaLanne was that one of the highlights of that entire experience was getting to meet Jack LaLanne and his wife, Elaine LaLanne. And he was so amazing. He was like 72 or something like that then. And he was the most fit man I'd ever seen in my life. This was not long after he had, you know, towed a rowboat with 20 people in it out to Alcatraz and back to shore, handcuffed hand and foot. And he could, at that age, lay out flat on the floor with his arms extended on his stomach and do fingertip push-ups and lift his chest off the floor. Have you ever tried to do one?
No.
You'll hurt your shoulder. I'm serious. They're remarkably difficult to do, and Jack could just pump them out. We actually did a promo before the show went on the air where Jack was doing fingertip push-ups on the floor, and Paul and I are walking along talking to camera, and we step over Jack and move along. But he was a wonderful guy. He was on the show. Wayne Satz was a very droll and funny reporter that was on the show. Nancy Collins was more of a serious interviewer. She did kind of newsmaker interviews. And part of the problem with the show was that they could not decide, or at least Barry couldn't decide, what he wanted the show to be. He wanted it to have some elements of serious news. He wanted to make fun of the news. He actually said to us one day, early in the process, I want people to never know what they're going to see when they tune into this show. And if I learned anything from the experience, that is a dreadful idea for a television show, especially a strip show that's on five nights a week. If you want people to tune in every night, they want to know exactly what to expect.
Well, the sort of, I guess, eventual disaster of Wilton North has produced some pretty fine writing. And the listeners may go check out the web, this article in Spy Magazine, Paul Krasner's writer's viewpoint of how it all went
Krasner
south.
Krasner was horribly, horribly bitter about the way this all turned out because he thought this was going to be, you know, his Emmy, and it never happened. And well, one of the things that bothered me most about Krasner was that Krasner acted like, and when you read the Times article, if you take a look at it, he acts as if it was all our fault. When Krasner actually spent time on the air as a contributor on camera, and he contributed to the show's demise as much as anyone. He was awful on camera. But he kind of had this aura about him that everybody thought, oh, he's a serious writer. And, you know, Krasner goes back to, like, Kerouac.
His name's been out there since the 60s.
And the Beat Generation. I mean, it's bizarre how people have deified this guy. I've never thought he was very funny. And he wasn't on the show. It was, I'd like to say there were better memories of it. The reviews were awful. There were a few that were kind, but, you know, none glowing, believe me, because then nobody deserved to be lampooned as much as we did. The one that was hurtful to me was, of all people, Tom Shales. Right? I mean, he was writing for the Post, Washington Post, and he wrote a review of the show, and it was scathing. And one of the segments on the show that he watched and based his review on was they had some filmmaker go out and do a package about London Lee. And London Lee, I don't know if you remember him. He was an Ed Sullivan-era stand-up comic. And was still, in a bad toupee, going and working the Catskills every summer.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, the perspective of this writing staff was that isn't this hokey? London Lee is still up there telling these horrible old jokes to old Jews in old resorts.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul and I saw the package and thought, oh, man, you know, the guy's making a living. Leave him alone. And so they had written some stuff for us to say before and wrapped around this package. And Tom Shales just savaged us. Said, who are these two nobodies, Robbins and Cowan, to take shots at a guy like London Lee? And what hurt the most was if Tom Shales had known how much Paul and I toned down the acidity of their comments, he might have thought differently. But, you know, people don't know.
Well, in closing, Phil, Wilton North went south, but you guys took another crack at it on TV with the Answer Guys and did well. Got a couple Emmys.
Yeah, we did. Won a couple of regional Emmys, got nominated for a Cable Ace Award. We you know, I have no complaints. It makes for some interesting stories to tell.
But I'm guessing you wouldn't go back to TV again.
Probably not. I would really like to wish all the best to Conan O'Brien. I hope he does well. I think NBC just hosed that poor guy. This was all their doing and their mistake, and he's the guy who suffered. Although if you call accepting a check for $40 million suffering,
you'll suffer.
Tie me to the cross.
We've been speaking with radio personality, actor, and comedian Phil Cowan about hosting one of Fox Television's unsuccessful attempts to beat The Tonight Show. Phil Cowan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. Always a pleasure.
After a short break, we'll talk with Representative Dan Lundgren about a serious problem and what he and some other people would like to do to stop it. Don't go away. Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Douglas Everett. The abuse of children around the world by sex traffickers is a problem that Congressman Dan Lundgren of California's 3rd District is intent upon doing something about. Representative Lundgren is sponsoring legislation to try and extend the reach of Megan's Law internationally while developing a task force for the greater Sacramento area. He's also hosting a forum to take place tomorrow in Rancho Cordova to draw attention to this issue. He's here in studio with us to talk about this most serious issue. I'm honored to say, welcome to Insight, Congressman Dan Lundgren.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is a member of tomorrow's panel, Truckee Police Chief Nicholas Sensley. Chief Sensley's written human trafficking guidelines for the U.S. Justice Department. Chief Sensley, welcome to Insight.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Well, Congressman, I'd like to start by asking, how did you first become aware of this problem?
Well, I started working on Megan's Law back when I was Attorney General, and that whole question was making sure that members of the public, law-abiding members of the public, could have some information about the convicted sex offenders in their midst. You know, when you're convicted of a criminal offense, a felony, in California or any place else in the country, that's a public record. But the problem used to be that that was the most hidden public record there was, and we weren't trusting law-abiding citizens with that information. So I worked on that, and we got it passed here in California. Now every state in the union has something like that. The problem is, or a part of the problem, is the fact that you have some people who leave the United States. They are sex offenders, and they go overseas, and they victimize children as young as 10 years of age for sexual depravity. And what we want to do is to extend the reach of the law such that we require people, if they're registered sex offenders in the United States, to notify the authorities that they're going to go overseas so that we can give fair warning to these other countries. Our hope is those countries will also reciprocate with us, give us information about their sex offenders who are intent on coming to the United States. And we also give the Secretary of State the ability to cancel passports, deny entry for individuals who have engaged in such conduct in the past.
Well, Chief Sensley, I was surprised to read in the Sacramento Bee that that Sacramento is reported by the FBI to be one of the top cities in the U.S. for child prostitution. And are minors brought in from elsewhere? How does that work?
Well, unfortunately, part of the problem is that many of the minors that are involved in this activity are U.S. citizens. They're teenage runaways who are very vulnerable to this particular issue. There's one statistic that says that there's an 85% chance that by the time a teenage girl runs away the third time, she is being commercially sexually exploited, which by law and definition, that's human trafficking. Mm. So it is a significant issue both for U.S. citizens and for foreign nationals. It is an opportunistic crime, just like any other, where these young women, the young girls, and young boys are vulnerable. There is someone there to take advantage of it.
Well, Congressman Lundgren, I know that Mexico's ambassador is working with you in this matter. And what steps are planned between the U.S. and Mexico to stem the traffic between the two countries?
Well, it's interesting because we have to get into arrangements with a number of different countries around the world so that we together can fight this terrible trade. And I had the opportunity, I know the ambassador fairly well, and he brought the Attorney General of Mexico in to see me a number of months ago. And when we were discussing issues, I brought this up, and I talked about my passion for dealing with this problem, how I was one of the co-authors of this legislation by Chris Smith of New Jersey, who frankly, I think is the William Wilberforce of this Congress. He's done magnificent work on the problem of sex traffic, human trafficking, denial of rights of parents around the world, and so forth. And so when we had this discussion with the ambassador and the attorney general in my office, when I raised the issue, they immediately positively responded. They indicated that they see this as a serious problem in their country. They want to work with us. There are reports from our State Department that I believe as many as 17 or 20,000 young people being sexually trafficked in and around our border with Mexico. So Mexico recognizes this as a problem for themselves, recognizes this as a problem in this country, and are indicating they want to work with us to positively respond to it.
Well, Chief Sensley, I'd like to ask you, this is a wonderful idea to reach out to other countries, but if you take a place like Thailand, where plane loads of tourists from Japan go there on these sex tours, how can we expect the officials there to do something when they have this long tradition of looking the other way?
That is indeed a part of the issue that is paramount to the Congressman's effort to bring about this international version of Megan's Law. There have been a number of studies in the past to see what the alignment is in several countries, particularly countries like Thailand, where there had been a history of significant sex tourism with these countries. I think the great effort that could come out of this, or the great outcome from this effort, is that we can begin to find more alignment in laws, because the differences in definitions of a sex crime is rather diverse throughout the world. And if we are going to have international cooperation, it has to begin with a very diligent effort to find some congruency in defining this problem, because our children are ultimately the ones who are suffering, and we don't want these people to freely pass across the borders.
As a matter of fact, if you look at the success we've had working with the government of Cambodia, there's another country that unfortunately has had a reputation for sex trade as part of their tourism. Mm-hmm. And this last year, for instance, we had a trailblazing effort where U.S. authorities working with those in Cambodia result in the arrest of three Californians, actually, who were involved, alleged to be involved, in sexual conduct with children. One of them would ride on his motor scooter through the villages and toss money out as a way to attract the kids. One of them was 41 years of age, but one of them was 75 years of age. And these are individuals who had criminal backgrounds. That is, they had committed crimes, had been convicted in the United States, were registered sex offenders, basically thought the pickings were better if they could go to a foreign country. But this kind of awful criminal activity's got to stop. And one of the things we do in the legislation is to provide some ability, some authority for the Secretary of State to engage with these other countries and actually extend certain foreign assistance to those countries if they do work with us in these efforts.
And a lot of people are getting together tomorrow, I guess, for this forum that you're hosting. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we're going to have this forum. It's going to be at Rancho Cordova at the City Hall. It's by invitation only in the sense that we have invited people from law enforcement, people from the education community, people who are experts in these fields. We've had a tremendous response from law enforcement all throughout the area. And one of the things we're trying to underscore is while we are concerned about children being brought here from other countries or children from here being brought to other countries, we have a homegrown problem right here. And when we say we're in the top five, as a matter of fact, in one of the FBI sting operations that took place in the last year and a half, Sacramento ranked number two in the number of people that were arrested in that process and the number of children that were basically freed from exploitation, at least for a short time. And people say, well, why would that be the case? Well, part of it is we happen to be at the intersection of major interstate freeways going from north to south and east to west. Additionally, we have a lot of these young people in the Northern California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada area that have come from abused family situations. And unfortunately, these pimps seem to extend themselves as the only kind of quote-unquote love or concern for these kids. And so these kids have been put into a warped sense of acceptance and caring, and these pimps know exactly what they're doing. And they get these kids in it, and it is difficult. It is tragically difficult to get them out of it. And there are a number of different things going on here, not only cooperation with the local law enforcement, state law enforcement, the FBI and their task force in this region. We have some people stepping forward in private organizations trying to create some environments of protection for these kids. Once we get them out, we have to get them in a setting where they feel they're protected and they feel an opportunity to be loved and to be comforted outside of either an abusive family situation or this abusive situation with a pimp. That is not easy. It's much easier to state the problem than it is to take care of the problem. But we have people stepping forward in this community. What we want to do is raise the concern. And so that's why I'm having this forum tomorrow. We do have the participation of the ambassador to the United States from Mexico, Arturo Sorokin. He and I have worked on a number of things together. We're also going to have the senior special agent Dave Meadows of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, ICE. They're the ones that deal with the people coming in and out of this country legally and illegally. Sacramento County Sheriff John McGinnis, and of course the Truckee Police Chief Nick Sensley. So we think we have a good panel of experts, and we're not going to answer all the questions tomorrow. We're not going to solve all the problems. This is an effort to try and get some attention directed to this, because we do have the press there for the general public, but also to get a better level of coordination among all of these different participants.
Our guests have been Congressman Dan Lundgren and Truckee Police Chief Nicholas Sensley. They are working to curb the abuses of women and children by those who engage in human sex trafficking, both home and abroad. We will have information about tomorrow's forum on our website, capradio.org/insight. Congressman Lundgren and Chief Sensley, I want to thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Insight. I'm Douglas Everett. I can be heard at radioparallax.com. Our associate producer today was Lynn Weaver, technical director Evan Matzler. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Thanks for joining us.